Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
Welcome back, listeners. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our new producer, Dom Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. So, Bernie, what did you think of our last podcast when we discussed 3P initiatives with Darren McCorriston?
You know, Fred, worked in the healthcare sector, and those type of initiatives were looked at different points of time. There are a lot of opportunities in the P3 space, and having come from the healthcare sector, it's helped some places out where you don't have a lot of capital. And if you're looking for the private sector to come in, it can be really handy. I mean, it's a bit of a dance. You got to be careful that you're not putting anybody off, but at the same time, some great opportunities. I can foresee that even doing it for housing development in that sector, you know, to meet emergency housing, whether it's people coming to Canada, whether those that don't have housing, it might be a perfect solution in the mapping or in the making to have happen.
I think you're dead on, Bernie, in your assessment. A public-private partnership can be, and I think really what we gathered after having Darren on the show was that 3P initiatives can be a win-win-win situation. So investors, anyone listening out there, please, by all means, take a closer look at a 3P initiative if it crosses your desk. They can be really worthwhile for all involved. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
You've got me. John, Rebecca, and the rest of the Saturday Morning Investment Club at St. Petersburg, Florida, have been enjoying listening to the podcast together, and several of them have taken your intro courses 1 through 4. You talk about conducting an in-person seminar focused on co-tenancies. When are you coming down to visit us?
I love visiting Florida, and I thank you very much for your email. I'll tell you what, if a dozen or more of you would be interested in attending, I would be thrilled to set up a date and time to put a seminar on. Just let us know, and we'll do the rest. Thank you again, John, Rebecca, and the rest of the Saturday Morning Investment Club crew.
We have a second letter. It's Robert from London, Ontario. He's a little confused as to what net lease versus net lease means. It seems it means different things depending on who you are talking to.
Happy to help, Robert. Yes, that's true. Not just amongst the public, but real estate professionals as well. I've taken a page out of one of the Gentry Learning courses that are now available to better explain it to you. Here we go. Let's talk about a net lease or a single net lease. A single net lease generally means that in addition to the negotiated base rent, that the tenant is also responsible for their proportionate share of property taxes. Another way to look at this is to say that the base rent includes all expenses with the exception of the property taxes. So that's what you would call a net lease or a single net lease. A double net lease means that the tenant, in addition to their base rent, is also responsible for their proportionate share of both property taxes and the insurance premiums related to the property itself. So in a net, base plus taxes, a double net, base plus taxes and insurance. Now, a triple net or an absolute net lease tells us that in addition to the base rent, the tenant is responsible for their proportionate share of all expenses related to the operation of the building. And when I say all, that can include capital repairs as well. Now, usually what will happen in a commercial situation is that, let's say you're an occupant in a strip plaza and the roof needs to be replaced. Well, it wouldn't be fair if there's half a dozen of you in the strip plaza to expect each and every one of you to pay 1/6 the cost of replacing or repairing the roof. So what will happen in a case like that is the cost of the roof will be amortized over the lifespan. Let's say if it's a flat roof, it's probably 35 to 40 years. And that proportionate share, that amount of monies broken down over 40 years, will be shared amongst the tenants then. So something to kind of keep in mind, a lot of people don't understand or appreciate that. They know about the snow, they know about the grass, they know about window replacement, but if there's a big capital expenditure, if you're a tenant and you have a triple net lease, you may be asked to contribute towards the repair or replacement of, for instance, a roof system. So keep that in mind. I'm negotiating a lease right now where that is the exact situation. Now, in the situation I'm speaking of, I took the prospective tenant inside the property and there was an obvious roof leak. When we negotiated the offer to lease, it very clearly stipulated that the tenant would be responsible for any and all capital repairs, and there was quite an exhaustive list. So what we did is we removed the roof portion of that, because obviously that roof, if it's leaking now, will probably cause issues or problems in the not too distant future. The last thing, although you didn't ask for it, is let me tell you what a gross lease is. A gross lease means that the base rent includes all expenses related to the operation of the building. The tenant is not responsible for any other amount except for the payment of the base rent to the landlord. Now, keep in mind, there are, of course, hybrids. However, the preceding is generally the accepted terminology. I hope that helps. Thank you.
All right, that's it for the mailbag. And of course, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
So folks, if you have any questions for Fred, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Welcome back, listeners. It's not often we have a guest who has such an exhaustive bio on Wikipedia, but here's the Cole's Notes or the Freddie's Notes version. And listeners, we're going to post the wiki link in the podcast notes if you want to find out even more about our guest today. Suffice it enough to say that our guest has an amazing amount of knowledge and experience on today's topic. Fred has over 12 years' experience as the mayor of Hamilton under his belt and is the former president and CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute. He is currently an advisor to Pathway Group, whose focus is on government relations and public affairs. Listeners, I am pleased to introduce to you His Worship, Fred Eisenberger, three-term mayor of Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Thank you, Fred. I prefer His Worshipfulness, if you don't mind. I thought if people are going to go down that road, let's make it really, really formal. So it always made me kind of look behind me when someone said Your Worship. I was thinking, well, you can't be talking about me, but I got used to the handle after a while, for sure. But glad to be here, and interesting topic to delve into, for sure.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to have you. So let's get right into this, Fred. You have an incredible background in both municipal and urban planning. Tell us about your time with the Canadian Urban Institute.
It was a delightful break between my first 4 years as mayor and my next 8 years as mayor. So I got the heave-ho after 4 years in office for various reasons, too complex to get into, but a stadium comes to mind. But notwithstanding all that, I had the opportunity to be the present CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute, which was both a domestic research institute about, you know, significant matters of having to do with cities, you know, whether it's parking or intensification or the value of our downtowns or free parking or not free parking. All of those were kind of research areas for the institute, and it obviously had impact right across the country. And the second part of their mandate, which was even more interesting for myself, was that we had exchange of knowledge between the Philippines, Ukraine, Somalia, and Jamaica. And, you know, Different on behalf of the Canadian government, most of those projects. And some of it was, governance. And governance back when Ukraine wasn't being attacked by Russia was a big, big issue. You know, the certainly the corruption in government in Ukraine and the oligarchs and all of that, all of those issues have kind of lended itself to giving them an understanding of what good Canadian governance is. Unfortunately, obviously, they're not going to be able to pull all of that into effect these days. In the Philippines, we had tourism projects, we had city building projects, we had how do you exercise good, positive economic development. All lessons learned from our Canadian experience, whether it's through myself or other municipalities right across the country. And we'd often bring in mayors and councillors from other parts of the country to come along and help share their knowledge and wisdom in terms of what they've experienced in their municipalities that could be used in the Philippines, in Manila or Iloilo or various municipalities that are dealing with similar issues that we deal with, but at different levels. So the experience for me was get to understand that the challenges we face in municipalities and in countries is rather universal, but Philippines would be at a lower intensity level. They're looking for growing the middle class, providing more services than they're able to provide now. Similar to that in Jamaica, in the Ukraine, well-developed, services are good at that moment in time in any event. And their challenge was, what does good governance look like? And we share some of those examples. So it was a great international learning experience for me. I mean, I learned more than I'm sure I was able to share, just to get a different perspective of what's happening globally in municipalities right across the world.
What an amazing experience, Fred.
Oh, really? Incredible. Now, I did leave that job to come back to the mayor's position in the city of Hamilton. So it was interrupted by, it's a 16-year time frame and interrupted by 4 years, but I came back and did another 8 years. But prior to that, had already done 10 years as a counselor. So I know that you might ask, well, why would you step into that role? Well, I had some kind of practical experience in terms of seeing what that role is all about and why I wanted to step up into the kind of the mayorship to provide, additional leadership in our community.
That just says so much about you as an individual. It sounds like the mandate of the Canadian Urban Institute was well received, but do you believe it was effective?
I did. I mean, it's knowledge sharing, right? So, what municipalities and others do with that knowledge is another matter. The value for Canada being an agent for positive development in other countries, very, very helpful and certainly gives Canada a good reputation in terms of having interest in what happens in the Philippines or in Jamaica or in Somalia. And, a lot of those countries struggle in many different ways. And, some of the assistance that the government provides is direct monetary assistance for food and basic medical services, and other assistance that they provide is for providing, knowledge. And then what those municipalities do with that knowledge, you would like to think that it's at least building on their opportunity to do things better and continue to grow their municipalities in positive ways. The same applies to, right across the country. We had programs that basically involved every major large city in the country in terms of their downtowns. What does their downtown mean? What are the similarities in terms of the impacts across the country? And different municipalities are able to learn that they're not all that unique. They can learn from other municipalities and what they're doing in those municipalities. And the Canadian Urban Institute was kind of the glue that was able to share that information. Because normally, if you're the mayor of Hamilton, you're not spending a whole lot of time looking at Toronto. But there's lots to be learned from what's going on in Toronto. And so, who in our kind of national information sector is kind of aggregating that information and then able to share that right across the whole spectrum. So I think it had enormous value. What municipalities do with that information, that's a whole other matter. But I'd like to think that it made for a positive impact, incremental as it always is.
One thing that we're very fond of saying here is that experience is the best teacher. And there's no doubt in my mind that you brought a wealth of experience to the table, and the idea that you can share it with not just other municipalities across, domestically across Canada, but internationally says a great deal.
I'll tell you something interesting while we're on the topic of sharing. The Bloomberg Foundation, through the pandemic, actually gathered all mayors right across North America It was kind of a therapy session. I mean, we were all struggling, right? Every municipality, every council, every mayor was scratching their heads as to what are we doing? How are we doing it? How are we going to continue doing it? You know, what's the impact going to be? And the Bloomberg Foundation actually came together and said, we're going to gather up on Zoom platforms, information sharing ideas from all the various municipalities right across North America. And it was actually very, very effective because you got a sense that certainly you weren't alone in some of the impacts that you were facing. But you also got to learn what other municipalities were doing and how you could improve your implementation in your community throughout the pandemic, which for all of us, quite frankly, was a whole different environment that one anticipated or expected and was actually quite prepared for. And that organization, in terms of bringing people together, did a hallmark piece of work to bring all mayors together and say, here's what we think are best practices.
Fred, I noticed that you know, aside from the Canadian Urban Institute, you're also involved with the being a chair of the Hamilton Port Authority. What's the purpose of the Port Authority, and what's the particular mandate that they have in that space?
Yeah, I mean, for Hamilton specifically, a port is critical to what used to be, a waterfront filled with industry, narrowed down to in recent years more of a steel industry as opposed to what used to be here, which was Firestone and Studebaker and Procter & Gamble. I mean, the list goes on and on. All of that, most of that has gone. What remains is steelmaking capacity that required back at the turn of the century raw materials to come in from various places around North America through the Great Lakes and the Seaway to Hamilton for them to be able to produce the steel that they did. That was very much a foundation of the development of our country, quite frankly. And so the Port Authority was created by the business community at the turn of the previous century, then led to them owning a significant amount of land mass around the waterfront. That became a positive benefit for many, many years, but it also became a negative over the years because a lot of the waterfront that most people want access to was cut off by this Hamilton Harbor Commission, which is what it was called prior to it becoming a port authority. So in 2000, it became a port authority. I was delighted to be given the opportunity to chair the kind of founding new port authority that the mandate was to not only provide the capacity, the shipping capacity, and grow that to the degree that has grown, but also to open up opportunities for people to get access to their waterfront and harbor. And so that became the new mandate of the Port Authority. Previous to that, it was all business. They would sue anyone and anybody that got anywhere near anything having to do with shipping, navigation, Port Authority, or even if it wasn't directly connected, they wanted to protect their assets to the best degree possible. That changed after the Port Authority came into effect. And I think to the government's credit, the Chrétien government in the day, I think they really opened up not only the waterfront, but the opportunity for the port to grow. And it has grown significantly in terms of agribusiness, a whole range of new shipping opportunities that provides employment in our community. So one of our strengths in Hamilton has been our rail connection, our airport, the port, and the road network in terms of how we're situated throughout this area of North America. So, it's become a vital piece of our very important infrastructure.
Do you foresee that with the economic shift happening, where stuff has gone overseas and it's now coming back home to roost business-wise, do you foresee that that's going to double or quadruple in nature?
Yeah. So, one of the challenges that this port authority faced is that it's kind of locked in terms of the landmass capacity. So one of the last remaining infill projects, is being done. Infill is taboo these days in terms of, environmental water quality. I mean, one of the great success stories for Hamilton is the remediation of the harbor. Now, if you think back to that industrial phase at turn of the previous century, the harbor, the water body, was a dumping ground for anyone that wanted to get rid of any of the toxic materials they were using in terms of their production. It took about 50 years for us to gradually get the water quality back up again. And now the opportunity along the waterfront is being realized, but the port also realizes that their landmass is locked in. They need to be looking further afield to expand their shipping opportunities, and they've done that. So they've merged their port with Oshawa, So it's now the Hamilton Oshawa Port Authority. So they've captured more land where more new opportunity can land. And they're actually capturing some lands in Welland along the Welland Canal as part of the Seaway. Wow. Also, add new shipping and navigating opportunities in those locations. So they're not only are benefiting Hamilton in terms of employment opportunities, but benefiting Oshawa and benefiting, Welland as part of Niagara. So they needed to expand their land mass, and they've done that by acquisition.
Yeah. And the genesis for all that, Hamilton.
Yeah. I mean, it landed. Hamilton was blessed to have a port, and it was visionary on the part of the folks that were leading this community at the, early 1900s. The reality is that without the ability to ship in iron ore and coal and all the things required for steelmaking, we wouldn't have that that capacity in industry. And steelmaking industry in Hamilton is certainly not what it used to be. It's clean or cleaner, getting cleaner every day, but also not the employment landmass or not the employment opportunity it used to be either. What used to be done by about 40,000 people in terms of directly employed with DeFasco and Stelco, might now number in total of maybe 5,000 people, has grown significantly. And part of our challenge is how do we replace that employment base? And we've done that in part through the Port Authority. We've done that in part through creating an employment opportunity around the airport and looking for other opportunities globally to come in and provide those new commercial industrial opportunities that we're still looking to replace. That lost industrial capacity that we had, 50 or 60 years ago.
So I have to ask you this, what ever attracted you to the world of municipal politics in the first place? I can't imagine a situation where I'd just expose myself to that.
Well, it's not like I had a grand design. What I did have in mind way back in 1991 was I had an interest in politics. I mean, I've always had great debates with my dad about the national politics and local politics. And in my mind, I had, one day I'd like to, at least get into a kind of a leadership level of opportunity, largely driven back then by my thinking was that our community was not doing enough on the environmental side. What drove me was, where is the progress in terms of improving our environment, our air quality, our harbor quality? So that was the motivating factor for me. I can tell you the first run for office, I was successful by 19 votes. And back then it was two aldermen per ward. And as it turned out, two former aldermen that had run many, many times before, who were probably the age I am now, in their early 70s, wanted to come back. And that was one position that they were vying for. And I was able to see an opportunity and say, well, if they don't want either one of these guys, then maybe they want the new kid on the block. And as it turned out, that's the way it ended up. Reg Wheeler was a wonderful man and delightful. He came in second and he could have asked for a recount. And his answer to that was, let the kid have it. And off I went to my, the beginning of a political career. So that was the beginning of it. Wow. And then it just progressed. And, 9-10 years as a counselor, I finally got to a point where I thought, I think it's time for me to step up to a higher level of decision making here and leadership. And so I took a shot at mayor. Didn't win the first time, for sure, and invariably ended up doing some other great things. But ultimately, in 2006, I was successful.
Was there any particular mandate that you had that you ran with when you ran that first campaign for mayor? What was the big issue of the day?
There wasn't one at that moment in time. As I explained, there was like two long-term counselors vying for that second position. The other counselor was basically a shoo-in. I don't know if you know the name Dominic Agostino, but he'd been a counselor, young man, very aggressive, campaigned like crazy. He was a lock. For me, it was just competency, energy, enthusiasm, something new as opposed to the same old. I wasn't criticizing anyone. I was just saying, look, I care about the environment. I have background in urban planning. I have background in environmental sciences. I want to put all of that to use to improve our community. So there wasn't any kind of lightning rod issue that, was present at that moment in time. It was just a matter of putting on the table a different offering than the same old, same old. So that's kind of where it started. I mean, next campaigns got a little bit more issue oriented. You know, obviously economic development was a big issue, you know, in many of the campaigns. And I made a point my first term as mayor of doubling the economic development staff expenditure so that we could actually have better reach and do a much more effective job of promoting our community and developing those relationships that allows that new business to come into your community. Economic development used to be considered, you know, a lost expense because it's hard to see results, right? It's not instantaneous. It's all about long-term development relationships. And, you know, we spent an awful lot of time, you know, looking for opportunities that could come to Hamilton, whether it's in the airport or the port or wherever it might be. And we'd actually go and knock on doors. And you need staff and resources to do that. And you need to be able to stay the course. So those are the kinds of issues that I predominantly ran on to help Hamilton not become a bedroom community of Toronto, which we're not. You know, Hamilton has had its own history and has its own industry, has its own economic sphere, but also selling the notion that we're a regional economy and we need to kind of not necessarily compete with one another, but find our niche. And our niche continues to be for Hamilton, you know, looking for those individual opportunities that can fit into a port or a commercial industrial area around the airport, or, you know, the high-end research that's happening in health sciences right now in our hospital and research institutions. All of those are hallmarks for good, positive change.
Yeah, they are. And it really looks good on the city of Hamilton, because I think back to the city of Hamilton 40 years ago, it was very, very different than what it projects itself as being today. So, and that's all due to some very, very hard work, boots on the ground type of work. Let's start talking about the actual reason why I invited you on the show. I recognize this is a loaded question, but it has to be asked. How do you balance legislative direction regarding intensification, and we heard about Bill 23 and all that earlier during the show, with the needs of your constituents? So I need you to put on your mayor hat once again, or look at it from the perspective of city council.
The good news for Hamilton is that we implemented a lot of these measures before Bill 23 actually came into effect. So we'd already saw the online economy coming in a big way and shrinking retail capacity at some of our strip malls and malls, and came to understand that we needed to open up our zoning bylaws to allow for residential development on these locations. And if you think of, you know, any mall or even any strip mall, a lot of that retail is disappearing. What's going to be replaced by? So we'd already made that change. We'd already made the change to allow for secondary units in the large part of our city, mostly in the downtown area. We got the first start in terms of allowing for ancillary units and basement apartments and multi-unit in residential areas. We've now expanded that into all the suburban areas as well. So as of right, you can have a basement apartment. Now, there are parking issues and setback issues and, you know, those kinds of things that happen, but you can have an ancillary unit. You can build a secondary unit on your property if you have, you know, sufficient property size. And most 70s vintage residential properties have sufficient lot size to be able to accommodate ancillary units. And so we're kind of ahead of the curve, but it always is going to lend itself to conflict. So it's unavoidable. I think people always came to understand that spreading yourself out too far, too wide as a municipality was a costly affair, that the more you spread yourself out without dealing with the kind of intensification or maximizing the utility of the services you have, the higher the cost is going to go for each and every resident in your municipality. And so we've spent a lot of time educating people on the value of intensification, not just because it provides additional housing, but it can also reduce, or at least reduce, the increases of taxation going forward. So for Hamilton specifically, I mean, we're promoting a light rail transit system. The major reason that I promoted that was to allow for intensification along that corridor. What I would like to point out, though, is that in the minds of many people, when they think of intensification, they think of high-rise apartment buildings.
True.
That ain't necessarily so. if I can say it in a very normal way. It doesn't have to be thus. It can be what we just talked about, which is the density that Toronto has, for instance, and has had for many, many years, is that, you know, 1920s vintage residential properties have multi-units in them, most of them. In terms of affordability, that is a good way to go because it allows them to generate revenue on a property that's in the millions of dollars. And the only way they can afford it is to have these ancillary units attached to it. I had this experience in Markham and other places where they had purpose-built new housing that built in a base or the roughed in for a basement apartment and an apartment over top of the garage as ways where people can not only provide intensification, but generate enough revenue to be able to afford the very property that they're living in. All of those options are there. Our city had many of those already implemented. I think the government is a little late to the program, but I think making it a universal requirement is helpful. Although I think the stretch goal of 1.5 million housing units is laudable. I think it is probably more likely to happen through this kind of intensification policy through basement apartments, ancillary units. Those kinds of things, I think, are going to be the way that new housing is going to be developed. The cost of construction right now is through the roof. I already see that, you know, a lot of the developers that would have developed now, the projects that are ongoing are going to finish, but they're not necessarily launching new ones because the cost of development is high. Mortgage rates are high. They have to borrow money and the rate to borrow money is high. So that's a barrier that is going to, you know, hit us in the face. And, you know, talked about public-private partnerships. The only way that we're going to be able to deal with this affordable housing issues is through public-private partnerships. No developer is going to take this on their own. It's just not affordable for them. And so, the governments have to step in. The problem is for municipalities is there's an expectation that municipalities become the capital drive to be able to, and municipalities just don't have the resources to do that. And I think I sent you an article about, you know, the New Deal around fiscal, sharing that, has not yet happened. But the reality is that a lot is demanded of cities today. A lot of the services are being provided, but the revenue stream to be able to provide them just isn't there. And so there's got to be a new way of managing this fiscal arrangement so it's more predictable funding that a municipality can count on so they can actually make some long-term planning decisions on how they're going to achieve more affordable housing, how they're going to achieve more services, how they're going to achieve improving and retrofitting their infrastructure. And with declining development charges, which I from a developer's point of view, I think, you know, sounds great, but for municipalities, it is one of the most significant resources that allows them to provide the services that they provide.
And you raise some very, very interesting and important points, many of which we've echoed on the show here. But do you think and it sounds to me like Hamilton has really been ahead of the curve on this entire issue, which is just wonderful to hear. But do you think it's fair? Do you think it's fair to download all this, even in light of building fund that the feds have recently promoted, and they're making quite a big splash about it in various municipalities all over Canada, not just in Ontario. Right. But do you think it's fair to have the responsibility for that downloaded to the municipalities, particularly when it's my opinion that a lot of the issues behind this affordable housing crisis were driven by federal policy to begin with? So I don't want to get really into the politics of it all, but knee jerk. Fred, do you think it's fair?
No, I mean, the whole fiscal arrangement isn't fair. That was the point in my op-ed is it's based on the BNA Act of, 150 years ago, where, we are creatures of the province and the province is a creature of the federal government in terms of its federation. But the reality is that the amount of money coming to municipalities from both the federal and provincial governments is shrinking, and the demands on municipalities in terms of providing services is increasing significantly. You know, when you look at the homelessness issues, you look at healthcare, where healthcare providers, hospitals are looking to municipalities for contributions to provide healthcare. Universities are looking at municipalities to provide, you know, money and resources to. And their argument always is, well, if you're in, then the feds and the province will be in. Well, I mean, it's a haphazard, unpredictable way of organizing your fiscal arrangement in the country. And so there's got to be a better way. And I point to back in the day when, you know, the GST was 7%. And, you know, for political reasons, I would argue we could have used those 7% through the pandemic. And now with all the infrastructure challenges we have and all the housing challenges we have. But we made the argument back in the day with then Mayor David Miller, myself, and a number of others as part of the Canadian Federation of Municipalities that we should get 1 cent of the GST given to municipalities. So then you would know that this is predictable funding that you can then plan with and actually, you know, look down the road and say, here's where I'm going to align the resources I'm getting as a result of this benefit that I'm getting from the federal government. All of that now today is all cap and hand stuff. Basically, you know, if you've got a failing sewage treatment plant, you have to make application to the federal government. And if the politics is right and your timing is good, then maybe you'll get the resources. And if it isn't, well, then you won't. And then you're on your own. So the picture is increasing demands for municipalities and increasing costs, reduced, revenues coming from federal and provincial governments. That equation can't work. It's just not sustainable. So somewhere along the line, it has to rearrange itself. And yeah, it might mean opening up the Constitution to have a look at what's the current reality in terms of where are most of the services being delivered today. It's not in the rural communities. And most of the people in rural communities are coming to cities to get the services that they need. And so how do we fix that fiscal reality to reflect where the demands are in our communities? So no, I don't think it's fair. I think it's unsustainable. I think it needs to be looked at. I'll give the current government a lot of credit because they did essentially say to municipalities, we're going to be a better partner to you than past governments have been. And they've actually held true to that. So I would say it's improved, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be.
And it almost would sound like it'd be prudent to have a large reserve fund, not just for the municipality itself, but you know, wherever the province or the feds come into play. They know the assets are out there. It's not like, you know, it's the lawn. It comes and it goes. You have a sewage treatment plant or a water treatment plant, certain infrastructure. It almost would make sense to have a master reserve fund. You know what assets are out there. You know, even having worked in healthcare, the buildings get old. You know, and then someone says, oh, by the way, you have certain toxic materials that are in there. Good luck getting rid of that. You know, but it would almost make sense to have a master reserve fund to anticipate things are going to have to get flipped over. Hopefully with tech, it gets a little more, or tech enhancements, it will get more positive, less expense.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the provincial requirements that I think is wise is that all municipalities now are required to do an asset management plan. It's not brand new, but it's relatively new. And you know, that's a very sensible thing for municipalities to do. The unfortunate part is that even though you might have an asset management plan, you don't have the resources to be able to go and fix those assets that you've already now determined are, you know, substandard or need improvement. And so where do those resources come from? So in terms of your point where, you know, there's got to be some sort of a focused reserve that allows for some predictability. And I think that's really the key issue, right? We know, and municipalities now know that 10 years down the road, we're going to have to beef up our sewage treatment plant because our population is growing. You know, if you go from 500,000 people to 600,000 people or 700,000 people, then you need more capacity in your sewage treatment plant. So it's all very fairly predictable. The question is, how do you manage that? How do you marry that predictability with the appropriate resources that are going to be needed at that moment in time to be able to do that work? Politics is not very good at long-range planning. And that's always been a kind of a sticky point for me, is that I was more focused on, and that's why my elections were, you know, not always slam dunks, because I was more focused on what do we need down the road? Look down the road and determine what is going to impact your community and what decisions you make now are going to impact what happens then. And so politics tends to be the immediate. What have you done for me today and tomorrow? But, you know, what we need to do more of is looking at that future and being prepared for it rather than just responding and reacting to it when it happens. Pandemic included. I mean, you know, now that we know that the likelihood of a pandemic and the impacts that it might have, How are we planning for it? How are we preparing for it? And that's certainly something that is reasonable to ask the federal and provincial governments in terms of, you know, what's our preparedness plan now, given all the information we have.
And it's not clear cut where the funding comes from either, particularly when you rely so much on different levels of government to help subsidize or pay for some of these capital improvements. When you're dealing with what we refer to as a building survey, where every structure of a building is looked at and analyzed for life expectancy and replacement costs, not unlike a reserve fund study, which you'll find when you're dealing with condominium projects. Those are very detailed documents that break down every component and, you know, assess a certain life expectancy to them. And based on that, that's how you build your reserve fund up. The issue with the municipality is it's far more involved than that, number one, but you don't have the consistency of bona fide funding from the various levels of government because it's so sensitive to political change.
There is one source that both the previous government and this government has maintained, which is a portion of the gas tax that they've been able to flow to municipalities, and that's been a real help. It isn't the ultimate answer, but it's been a real help. And it's that kind of sustained commitment that municipalities can rely on, that they can plan with that kind of sustainable funding. So an improvement, and I mentioned, you know, whether it's part of the provincial sales tax, depending on where you are in the country, or it's a portion of the GST or some sort of source that says, we know this is coming and this is what we can do with the resources that we've identified here. But to have reduced envelopes of funding in a global sense from both federal and provincial governments is completely unsustainable, and we just cannot continue to function in our major municipalities with that kind of unpredictable resourcing.
Absolutely agree. Bernie?
Oh, I got more questions. So I heard recently, and this I think it's from the federal side, they were giving tax relief to people building and doing construction phases. Would that be another avenue for a municipality then to seek relief? You know, in other words, they're not paying the HST or the GST in this case. Would that be another layer of just, you know, make it easier here?
Yeah, I think, you know, given the circumstance we're in, I mean, the housing crisis didn't happen overnight. It's been developing for quite some time, and it's now kind of pandemic kind of accelerated, you know, a whole series of problems. And right now it's staring us in the face. And so the assistance that they're getting in terms of, you know, waiving the HST and the GST, that certainly is a benefit to developers, no question, and their opportunities to develop. But I mean, I'll still maintain that only through public-private partnerships are we going to be able to deal with this housing crisis. That doesn't mean regular housing isn't going to be developed, and I think it is if it's affordable and viable and it's saleable. Still going to happen, but on the affordable housing front, it is going to take an effort from both the federal, provincial, municipal, and private sector to come together and make that work. And whatever benefit, and so we're providing as a municipality, you know, land, take a parking lot. We're not going to charge you for that parking lot. And land costs being one of the most significant barriers for development. We have parking lots that we probably don't need that we can offer up as opportunities for people to do development on. And so that's one way the municipality can help. And then the province can waive sales tax, and the federal government can waive HST. And through all of that, you might be able to come to a package that's affordable to build and affordable to own or rent. And, you know, and that's the other, the barrier that we face is, the pricing has gone through the roof, rationally or irrationally. It's hard to know. But the reality is that a single family, one bedroom apartment in Hamilton is renting for $1,700, $1,800, in the space of 4 years, it's virtually doubled. And so that's another affordability issues that others are going to have to wrap their heads around in terms of subsidization and other opportunities to provide benefits to people that might help offset that additional cost.
Yeah, it's your typical and your ongoing supply and demand argument. I mean, this is really what it's all revolving around. And I just don't see an end to the current situation unless there's some seriously drastic provisions made to address it.
Yeah. One of the changes I think will be helpful is this whole issue around tradespeople. And I, you know, UN International President Joe Manchinelli lives in Hamilton, have many, many conversations. And he would argue in the province of Ontario alone, we need about 30,000 tradespeople, electricians, carpenters, bricklayers.
Oh, I can believe it.
We don't have them. They don't exist. You can't flip a switch and make that happen. They're kicking in their training programs to help bring more people through the program. They're reaching out to, you know, young people in the high schools. And that's, I think, important and helpful. But they're also changing the immigration laws to move away from, you know, how much money do you have in the bank, as opposed to what kind of trade can you bring to this country that can help us, you know, build that housing volume that we need. So I think the changes, I think the opportunity to make those changes are there, but it's going to take 10 years. And, you know, you don't replace 30,000 tradespeople, and not even in 10 years. It might take longer than that. And so the hope is, and you got to have a stretch goal. And I totally agree that, you know, a stretch goal is important. Am I optimistic that we can achieve that through regular housing building? I don't think so. I think other things have to come to play to be able to provide new housing opportunities, and some of those things we've already talked about.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, case in point, I think there's a current demand for up to something like 250,000 new housing units a year. And right now we're practically at an historic low, and builders today have only committed to building half that this year. It's actually gone down rather than increasing. Even though the mandate has increased, the demand has increased, the number of new housing units has plummeted. Yeah. And you bring up a very, very important point.
But the economics isn't there. I mean, I know many developers, and they're saying, look, I can't develop that now, given the costs that I'm going to have to bear. It's not, and, you know, who knows what happens with interest rates. And in our lifetime, interest rates have doubled and quadrupled. You know, my first house, I started with 19%.
Me too.
But the numbers were different, right? So yeah, that 19% on a $40,000, you know, acquisition, that's not a particularly dramatic number. But in my lifetime, 9% has been about the average. Right now, we're at 5-6%, which is pretty darn good. It does need to come down. Unfortunately, I think our government, or at least our interest rate policy, stayed too low too long, and far too many people have bought too much with too much mortgage and too much house. And now, you know, at triple the interest rate cost, which is still a 6% reasonable rate, in relatively speaking, puts them out of the house, out of the housing market. It's a real problem. And banks are being helpful. I think they're doing everything they can to keep people in place. But those are, you know, additional challenges that are being faced right now, as people are making decisions around, can I afford or not afford?
Yeah. Case in point.
Would you suggest then that, kind of leading into the back to, you know, intensification, would you want to see more activity inside the existing urban boundaries or expand it just on the periphery? Is there a kind of a happy balance? Because, you know, if I'm putting in another suite on my property because I have space, or I have a purpose-built structure where I can sever off part of the house and rent it, so it's fully serviceable.
You know, one of the misnomers around the urban boundary is that if you don't expand the urban boundary, you have no land left to develop. And, you know, the requirement around the urban boundary through legislation and through planning policy is that you're required to have, I think, minimum 20 or 25 years of available land mass to accommodate future development. So it's not a matter of you draw a line and you know, you can't go past that line. Within that line, there is capacity for future development. So my view has always been explore, you know, as many infill and redesigned opportunities before you start expanding your urban boundary. Because again, we all remember SimCity, playing SimCity once upon a time, where you know, you develop that town. Well, if you spread it way out, your cost goes through the roof. And that's real. I mean, that's not an imaginary issue. That's a real issue for your municipality. So, you know, not only does it your development cause more services to be provided, hard services to be provided, it also causes more soft services to be provided. People demand rec centers and libraries and all those kinds of things that make for a decent community becomes part of new developments that are happening within your municipality. So you factor in all those costs, you want to contain as much of that on existing infrastructure as possible from a city perspective. and generate more revenue off of that so that you can afford to maintain that taxation levels to, you know, reasonable numbers. If you fail to do that, then you're forever going to be going to the well for additional tax dollars to be able to afford that sprawl. So, you know, it's and sprawl is kind of a misnomer these days. I don't think very municipalities sprawl anymore. I think they've all kind of wrapped their heads around how do we contain development to a degree that makes sense. So provide a reasonable amount of development opportunity within the urban boundary, but don't expand the urban boundary unnecessarily until, you know, such time as you've explored all the other options for intensification and or infill. And infill, you know, there are a lot of infill opportunities, and there's a lot of opportunities. When I think of, you know, Hamilton specifically, why did we pick, you know, LRT along the kind of the oldest main street in our city? Is because the oldest main street in our city is got a lot of tired, underutilized housing in it that needs to be renewed and revamped. And so, you know, you can look at some of those existing buildings and say, you know, some of those, you know, within 500 meters either side of the light rail development opportunity becomes redevelopment opportunities. Somebody will buy that property or assemble two or three or four of them and create, you know, a higher density. We already see that happening in an old neighborhood not too far from here where it had 100 geared-to-income housing units on a fairly significant piece of property built in the 1940s being turned into 700 units, 100 still geared-to-income, and the rest of them at different affordability levels and additional market opportunities as well. So it's going from 100 to like 600 or 700 units as opposed to, you know, leaving that landmass, which, you know, back then they built on large swaths of property. Today, we can fit a lot into those sites. We can fit a lot into mall locations. If you think of, you know, the major malls in your community, a lot of that retail is going out the window. And what better way to marry the interest in whatever services are being provided by the mall by having residential development right alongside it? It just makes perfect sense. So some of those opportunities, I think, are priority opportunities before you start looking at expanding your urban boundary.
Yeah, another good use, and what I'm seeing happening is a lot of these regional shopping centers are, like you said, they're suffering with vacancies. And some of the projects that you spoke of, rec centers, for instance, I mean, I'm seeing some shopping malls being repurposed just for that end use. Mm-hmm. Wonderful place to put up a rec center. It's a wonderful way to bring in private monies into, you know, supplying a service that the public is looking for, which otherwise would fall on the shoulders of the municipality. But right. Let's address the elephant in the room. I mean, how do you deal with those folks who vehemently oppose intensification within their neighborhoods? You know, the so-called NIMBYists, if I can use that term.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. You know what, my line on that always is that, you know, most everybody in a general sense supports intensification. They get it. But when it lands in their neighborhood, they say, well, I didn't mean here. I mean, over there, not in my neighborhood. But it happens. And, you know, it happens in many instances around redefined school sites. And we have, you know, constantly are having the challenge of school boards, which have an unenviable job of trying to figure out the demographics of future generations and trying to match the school capacity with that. A lot of the sites that schools sit on are huge, huge sites, and many of them are considered to be, you know, parkland for the neighborhood that that it resides in. Unfortunately, when that school, you know, changes, the school board is required to get market value for their property to be able to raise the funds to provide other schooling in other places, which then lends itself to the taxpayers saying, well, why do we have to pay twice for this piece of property? Because we paid for it originally, and now we're going to pay for it again, because invariably the pressure is on for the municipality to buy it. But we can't buy all of the school sites that are being transformed or changed or downsized or right-sized. And so the private sector is invited to come and participate in purchasing those properties. And when they look at it, they want higher density. And so in the middle of a suburban residential neighborhood, you know, all too often you get a developer that comes in that now, more so than ever, wants to put up a tower as opposed to, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 single family homes. And so that's where the conflict starts to happen. And I think scope and scale matters. So as I mentioned earlier, that people automatically go to, you know, high rises, 20 stories or more, doesn't necessarily have to be the case. The most efficient actually design from an environmental perspective is actually 6 or 7 stories where, you know, the cost of driving all of those services 20 or 30 stories into the air is not small. And so 6, 7, 8 stories is reasonable given the scale. It doesn't obliterate the shadowing in the neighborhood. And so there's really a matter of looking at, you know, what capacity does the neighborhood have? Trying to figure out what the neighbors want is a bit of a challenge. And so that's where we kind of get political leadership to try and overcome those issues where, you know, you have to be brave enough to say, look, folks, let's get back to, you know, understanding what intensification does for you as a property owner over the long run. And, you know, yes, it may bring more people into your community and your neighborhood. We're going to minimize the impacts from a parking perspective. We're going to minimize the impacts in terms of being able to provide the resources and fit them into the school and fit them into the library capacity and the rec center capacity. But the overall benefit is that we don't need to continue to sprawl out, and we can use these land masses to provide more housing for more people more quickly. So you got to be willing to make that pitch and not be too quick to move away from that. But we have these debates at councils, and you know, invariably the local councillor will stand up and staunchly oppose and, you know, put up the great fight. And with any luck at all, hopefully the other members of council will come together and say, well, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it is the right thing to do over the long run. So, you know, we see those battles going on all the time. And I remember, you know, as a counselor, you know, and it might be somewhat disingenuous, but obviously have a conversation with your councilmate saying, you know, I can't support this because it's my area, but do the right thing. You know, and that kind of level of interaction, I think, is important. And doing the right thing is tough. It's hard. Not easy. And political seats have been won and lost as a result of, you know, making a particular choice in a particular neighborhood. But ultimately, well, what are you there for? Are you there to just tag along with, are you there to look at the entire picture and make an assessment that, you know, over the long run, this is the right thing to do? Tough choices. And, you know, I see some new counselors that reach out to me every once in a while and lament the fact that they have to make these tough choices. Well, that's what you're there for. And, you know, don't spend too much time thinking about the next election. I mean, you might want to get elected again, but if you spend all your time thinking about that, then you're not going to be doing what's necessary for our communities. And now more so than ever, we need people that are prepared to stand up and do the right thing.
Yeah, that really do the right thing.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned doing the right thing. I've seen a community get excited about a healthcare facility. They really hated the no parking around, you know, the immediate neighborhood. Their house values went up. Originally, that was all Farmers Field, right? So it's a development, a transition. Mm-hmm. When the facility was promised to move elsewhere, like across the city, oh, we can't have that. We want the hospital close by. And so mm-hmm. He had competing interests. And I think that's that from a political point of view. The long-range plan is facility has to change. It just has to. It's aging out. And so it provided a lot of dilemma.
Yeah.
That's one hurdle. The other hurdles, like you mentioned already, about infrastructure, qualified tradespeople coming into place. How do you see the governments overcoming these shortfalls, these pitfalls, or these pockets of resistance, right? And you know that right now those people are looking at the short haul, a short view, and not the long range. How do you find that they're going to come past those pitfalls strategy-wise?
Well, I mean, I think one of the strategies is to look at immigration and start kind of adjusting who you're letting into the country and why. You know, and I'm an immigrant, so I'm not anti-immigration. I'm very pro-immigration, and Canada needs immigration. But you want to channel the kind of immigration that suits the demands of the community today, as opposed to what used to be necessary, which was you wanted people to come in and start new businesses and opportunities. And, you know, that's always wanted, of course. But right now we have that critical tradespeople shortage, and you really want to realign your immigration strategy to fill that bill. And so the sooner and the quicker they get to that, the better off we're going to be. And then, you know, it really comes down to ultimate leadership in terms of our party politics, federal, provincial, municipal, coming together and making a determination as to what the right thing to do is under this circumstance, and then making that ultimate commitment. And it really lends in municipalities, it's a matter of who you elect. You know, I would think that the current housing affordability strategy that is currently being evolved would have been a much more difficult sell in the previous councils that I dealt with, because their mindset was different. Today, we have a much more aligned council towards homelessness and affordability and the current crises that they're facing. And by the way, you know, it makes me laugh a little bit that every municipality is declaring an emergency of some kind or another. You know, we can't have emergencies happening everywhere. We have challenges for sure, but they're not all emergencies, although, you know, they're all issues that need to be dealt with and need to be kind of looked at. But every municipality, and, you know, the most recent one that declared another emergency is Belleville. And I think it came up in the news that, you know, their claim is that we can't deal with homelessness issues. And he's right. We can't, as a municipality, deal with those issues. We cannot be funding healthcare. We cannot be funding homelessness. All of those issues are well beyond the mandate of municipalities. But it's a particular mindset to be able to work with our federal and provincial partners to say, you need to step it up. And one of the things that they need to step up when it comes to homelessness and housing affordability and that issue is mental health and addiction treatment is substandard. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough of it available to actually help people get onto a different track. And, you know, it's not something that you can say, well, we will put you on a waiting list. The moment you decide that you want to get help and treatment is the moment that you need to have help and treatment. And so they need to expand the capacity of the mental health and addiction treatment significantly to be able to deal with what's happening in our broader community. And it will have a better impact on terms of housing and housing affordability. We could, in Hamilton right now, if we had wraparound supports, for instance, for mental health and addictions individuals, we could house 150 people. Most of those are on the street right now. We could house them if we had wraparound supports. In other words, mental health support treatment, addiction treatment. We have the housing capacity, but putting someone with those issues and putting them into housing doesn't work unless you have those wraparound issues available for them. Because they'll end up, you know, just taking whatever they're doing out in the broader community and doing that in the apartment and whatever unit they're in, it'll end up getting trashed and ruined and wrecked, and they'll be out of there in no time. As opposed to having the treatment capacity, having folks available for them to be able to get and stabilize their lives is something that is possible. So it really is going to be a multitude of coming together and providing that kind of strong leadership to say, we have to go down this road. It doesn't mean you have to be a dictator, but it does mean you have to have the strength of conviction to withstand the criticism and the pushback that you're going to get from people. And one of the biggest lightning rods, and I'm sure it happens in Ottawa as well, is addiction treatment facilities. The moment you mention providing an assisted drug addiction facility somewhere, the community's just inflamed. And the reality is that these facilities are needed if you want to solve some of these homelessness and encampment issues down the road. Because in the absence of that, you're just going to let these folks do whatever they need to do. And, you know, we have treatment. We have a needle exchange van that drives around to help people at least not share disease when they're, you know, doing drugs or, you know, shooting a needle in their arm. But they need much, much more than that. So that capacity has to grow. If we grow that capacity, I'm convinced that the ability for us to be able to house people and provide, you know, stable opportunities for them will increase substantially.
Well, you know what? You're talking about a multifaceted issue and problem that really requires determination and strong leadership. And based on that personal assessment, I think you should run for the highest office in the land and become a candidate for prime minister. Believe you me, at least you have such a firm and such a clear understanding of what the issues are. And you touch on so many of the points that we've raised on this show. Really. Anyways, let's carry on. We still have a few more questions on the agenda. Right. So tell me, do you feel that the Ontario provincial government stated goal, and this is a stated goal of building 1.5 million new homes by 2031 is both realistic and achievable. I mean, that's building slightly over 200,000 new homes a year when we've already said that I don't think we're going to be building many more than maybe 120 this current calendar year. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it's important to have a stretch goal. I mean, but do I believe that that's going to be achievable given all the circumstances that are out there working against that? I think it's going to be difficult. But we have to try. I mean, the reality is that there is a housing issue that we have to find ways of overcoming. And, you know, the sooner we get to figuring out how we can best achieve that, the better off we're going to be. Stretch goal is good. I always advocated stretch goals through our economic development. Maybe you won't get there, but striving towards that goal is going to be helpful. And so, the further along they can get, the better. Do I believe they're going to achieve it? I'm skeptical. I appreciate the effort, though.
This kind of goes in and flows well to the next question, then. Do you feel federal and provincial housing initiatives are an effective way to deal with this? Or are there things they should be doing, other initiatives that they haven't put in place yet?
No, I think it all boils down to money, quite frankly. I mean, it's money and the immigration issue and getting the capacity in terms of tradespeople, I think all of those issues have to come together. But fundamentally, at $500 a square foot, doesn't matter what you build, it's going to be $500 a square foot. You're going to have to find a way of funding that. And I think the only way that it happens is through P3s, PPP, public-private partnerships, people coming together, all levels of government, everybody making some sort of a contribution. And you talked about it earlier, whether it's GST or HST or provincial sales tax or land that the province has or the feds have or the municipalities have, all of those things need to come together. And the private sector will step up if they can, have a financially viable package for them. I mean, they want to make a few shekels, and that's fair. And so how do we package all that together to make it something that's affordable and viable for development to occur? And cities don't build houses. I mean, we do have our own, City Hamilton Housing that's done a fairly good job of looking at their assets and hiving off high value assets to be able to raise some money to provide more housing somewhere else that land values might be a little lower at. So I think they're doing their work. But more needs to be done. And I think it really is lending itself to the public-private partnership arrangement in the truest sense of the word. Municipalities, province, federal governments coming together with the private sector to figure out how can we all make this happen.
After World War II, there was a housing boon, a housing requirement. It drives through certain parts of Ottawa and I'll see, my gosh, they make those little small houses. And there's a lot of them.
Wartime houses.
Yeah, is that kind of the answer, that type of concept, but maybe not that structure?
Sorry. I don't know if you recall, and I suspect it happened in Ottawa, but back in the 70s, they had the Home Ownership Made Easy plan, which was the provincial government that had a chunk of land in various municipalities that said, we will lease the land to a homeowner, and we'll have developers build on them, in various different styles, not fancy housing, but decent housing. Semi-detached, single family, decent quality, but not top quality, but, something that'll stand the test of time. And, with the wartime houses, they were built quickly, and many of them are still standing today. And they're valuable pieces of property in our community. So that Home Ownership Made Easy plan was really a partnership for the provincial government and municipalities to come together and provide the least long-term lease benefit as opposed to having to purchase the land. And that was a great benefit for homeowners. And so, a lot of them got into the housing market as a result of that. And that kind of arrangement, I think, is part of what we need to start looking at is how do we make it financially viable for somebody to have home ownership or to have reasonable rental opportunities through that kind of, long-term lease arrangement, whether it's rental property or for sale. Mm-hmm. Some of those plans have existed before. And I know about the Home Ownership Made Easy plan because my parents actually took advantage of that. And, for the longest time, for 20 years or so, they leased the land. And then by the time they were at the end of the lease, they got to own it. and then could put it on the market as anyone would, as part of the value proposition that they would have being part of the real estate market. Otherwise, they would never have been able to get into the real estate market otherwise.
You know, there are communities in and around Ottawa where not so much now, because many of these arrangements have gone through their life cycle. And usually at the end of the cycle, what happens is that the property is offered for sale to the actual occupant or homeowner.
Right.
So we used to have many, many more going back 20 years ago, not so much now. I'd be hard just to point to a specific neighborhood, but I'm very familiar with what it is you speak of, Fred. And that could be time to resurrect just that, you know, just that offering. But it's a great point. So let's kind of shift gears here a bit, because the topic that we've been speaking about has been pretty heavy and involved. And I thank you for your patience, Fred. But can you tell us a little bit about your current career at ECS Consulting?
Actually, it's my own firm is now Stellar Consulting. I gave it a bit of a different name. And I'm working with Pathways, which is a government relations agency that works federally and provincially in terms of public policy on behalf of their clients. That's not the only thing I do, though. I do some advisory work for a couple of companies in the city of Hamilton, and as well as an energy project happening in Newfoundland. So strategic advice in terms of how you deal with municipalities. So I'm getting enough to do to keep me interested, but not too much that I can't do some of the things that I want to get at, which is I'm actively participating at the YMCA to volunteering to help them raise some funds. And like most social organizations, they've got a great big hole in their budget as a result of the pandemic, and they're looking to replace an aging facility. So there's a capital campaign going on. So I'm helping them on a volunteer basis connect with some of the financial resources that are in our broader community. So enough to keep me engaged in the volunteer sector, and also in the private sector. And so, but I also, want and need time to semi-retire. I'm not that spring chicken anymore. And I think I've given, as much as I can through the public sector over the last 30 years or so, that I'm interested in travel, and I'm interested in tennis and squash, and I'm thinking about pickleball. I don't know. It's the current craze. I'm not ready to give
up. Apparently.
Singles, but everybody's playing pickleball. So I get invited and I go. It's not crazy, about playing all that often, but nice to see people getting active in terms of, a lot of the tennis players and squash players of old have migrated to pickleball, and for good reason. I understand it. So sooner or later, I'll be a pickleball player too.
Wonderful. What a wonderful wrap up to this entire discussion this has been. Time for our rapid fire question segment, Fred. Are you ready for this?
Yeah. You want one word answers or a
one word answers? I mean, we're gonna ring the buzzer if there's more than three. Let's see how you fare with this. But before we do, tell me a little more about this energy project in Newfoundland you're dealing with. What's that all about?
So it's a green hydrogen and ammonia production facility. So wind turbines generate power to produce hydrogen, which is a huge commodity throughout the world, actually, hydrogen and ammonia. So those are the end products that are being generated as a result of the wind turbines. And Newfoundland, being the windy place that it is, I mean, it's a good marriage of green energy resources that can actually produce. So it'd be the first green hydrogen ammonia production facility in Canada if it comes to fruition. So pretty exciting project. And it replaces, so Abitibi Forestry was basically the predominant employer in Newfoundland, or at least this area of Newfoundland. And this project, proposes to kind of replace the employment opportunity that it created by generating this facility. So it's got some provincial approvals. It's got some federal, connections to that as well. And there's some financing dollars that are being sought out. And obviously there are municipalities that are impacted that are generally supportive. And so I'm helping them in terms of their strategic approach to, try and land this project in the fullness of what it proposes to do. So it's in the development stage. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. And it obviously has legs too. So I'm remiss. Let's get on to our rapid fire questions. Okay, Bernie, let's start from the top. I'll say one, you say two. Don't give him any time to think about it. All right, Bernie? Okay, here we go. Fred, what's your morning routine like?
You know, these days I have a dog and I generally take the dog back to City Hall to visit his buddy James. So I'm a chauffeur for a dog 2 or 3 days a week. So that's the start of my 2 or 3 days. Otherwise, it's down to the Y and get a workout in.
What's your favorite book?
I just read Eddie Goldberg's book on the Krechen years. So that's my favorite book at the moment. It was a great read. I really enjoyed it. And I tend to go to either urban city building, urban planning books or political biographies and the occasional, the occasional fictional high energy tome around whatever.
Favorite hobby or pastime?
It's tennis and squash for me is what I love to do. I mean, I like to run around and I like to get exercised and energized. And playing singles, tennis and squash makes me very happy these days.
What do you do to relax?
The most relaxing thing I can think of is getting a workout in. How you feel afterwards is where the benefit is. You know, beyond that, travel, music, books, and movies, all of it is part of the repertoire for sure.
Favorite place in the world to visit?
You know, you might know that I'm originally born in Amsterdam, and I have to be honest that variably what still feels like home, even though I left when I was 8 years old, but that imprint, I don't think ever leaves you, where you originally came from, wherever that is. So when I go to Amsterdam, it just has this whole kind of melancholy, reflective feeling about it. And so, I love to go there, but I have, a myriad of places that I have been. And myriads more that I'd like to get to. So my frog list is very, very long. You know what a frog list is? Things you do before you croak. So it's long, and there's many places I want to go, and we're gonna make our best efforts to get to them. But
I think I'm going to use that for sure. When was the last time you were back home?
Amsterdam 4 years ago. Yeah.
Bernie, so, yeah, take us home.
I'm due. And actually, we're talking about one of my distant relatives about a house swap between their place in Breda, Holland, and our place here in Hamilton. So that'd be an interesting house swap that we might do in June.
If you had, if you could have a coffee or tea with somebody, either living or dead, who would it be?
Well, I am a great fan. I mean, one of the unsung heroes of, mayoral politics, I think, globally is Michael Bloomberg. And, Michael Bloomberg was a great mayor, in my humble opinion, for New York City, but also, a business person that has had great success on the business side. And he's also operated a wonderful foundation that is connected, I think we talked about earlier, but, with municipalities, right across North America and the world, in fact. So continues to do exciting things. I've had a couple of conversations with him previously, but I'd really like to sit down with him face to face and have a conversation around how did you manage New York City? How did you develop your business? Where do those two issues collide, quite frankly? And, New York being probably one of the premier cities of the world, boy, would it be great to learn some of the lessons that they've learned in terms of how you make it function well.
You really know how to pick them, Fred. Sure, absolutely. That wraps things up. And before we move on to the word of the day, again, our thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on our show today, Fred. It's been a real eye-opening experience. The wealth of knowledge you bring to this topic is just unsurpassed, in my opinion. So thank you very much again.
Thank you, Fred. My pleasure. Anytime.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Welcome back, listeners. So today's word of the day, actually, we're going to talk about acronyms today. So the first one I want to address is NAR, N-A-R, which is short for National Association of Realtors. And what is that? The National Association of Realtors is an American trade association for those who work in the real estate industry. It's a trade association for realtors, primarily in the U.S. The next one I want to address is CREA, or the Canadian Real Estate Association. It's essentially the Canadian equivalent of NAR, But the formal definition is the Canadian Real Estate Association is, a trade association that represents real estate brokers, agents, and salespeople in Canada. So I hope that clears up the two differences, because believe you me, I get into discussions where people are using the terms interchangeably, and in some aspects, they're absolutely dead on. But remember, National Association of Realtors, Korea, Canadian Real Estate Association. And that's all she wrote. Thank you, Fred, once again for being our guest today. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
For me, it's Fred Eisenberg, just my name, at gmail.com is the quickest, easiest way. And that's it.
Perfect. That's wonderful. Great. Thank you again, Fred. It's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. So, listeners, join us next podcast where we'll be discussing business evaluations with our guest, Carolyn Troy. That should be interesting. It'll complement Guylaine's podcast of a few weeks back, where she talked about evaluating businesses, but more from a sales aspect. So tune in, folks. Should be really interesting. Bernie, anything to add?
This has been a great session. I appreciate Fred Eisenberger coming in and sharing the information, because it provides a perspective from, you know, running a city. It's the long game. Everything is fixable. Just you have to do it in concert, right? And there, it lends itself back to the adage, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
So folks, if you have any questions for Fred, or you want to ask questions, or you want to seek out information in the real estate space and investing in that space, or you want to know about Gentry Learning, just send an email to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
And to sum it all up, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Thank you, listeners. Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment, and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.